It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel, Carmel, California. Dialogue Conspiracy, I believe it's number 221. If you number them, I hope you do. I hope you take tape recordings each week and play them for your friends and relatives. It's June the 14th, 1976. You can even make copies and send them to your congressman if you want. I think that's a good idea, or your elected officials. 3 days from today on June 17th, and 4 years ago, 1972, was the anniversary. That was the time that the White House plumbers broke into the Watergate Hotel. And it is the fourth anniversary this week of what is now known and always was called by me the Watergate Affair. I got very excited that next morning, June 18th, 1972, immediately realized that these were the top people from the Central Intelligence Agency. They were a team that worked together since the Bay of Pigs invasion, and they were once more altering our electoral process. And then I sat down and wrote for 3 weeks the article for The Realist called Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? I knew that Martha Mitchell would not live until the fourth anniversary of Watergate. My coming back at KLRB last week was because Martha Mitchell was dying. Well, it was one of the factors that she was dying of cancer. And Martha Mitchell did not survive these 4 years. Her premature death caused by that rare bone marrow cancer was a tragedy, because she was literally injected and kidnapped and secluded and was a political prisoner. James McCord, convicted Watergate conspirator, had confirmed that Mrs. Mitchell was basically kidnapped in 1972 to keep her ignorant of the Watergate break-in. I think of a chemical that I have mentioned before on KLRB, or maybe I haven't. It's a chemical called cyclophosphamide. I think I've read various lectures this last spring where I've been. The article came out in the New England Medical Journal in July 1975. Cyclophosphamide is an injection, a drug given to political prisoners. It's being given in Chile. It causes the bladder to shrivel up, and the person eventually ceases to function. Their death is caused in a few years. And then they die at home and not in the prison, and the government is not blamed for their death. This was also carried in Earth News and London Observer. And I read now that Chile is releasing many of their prisoners, many of their prisoners, because they want aid from America. And I bring up this drug again because I think of Martha Mitchell, how you can give drugs if you are in the intelligence community or in the proper laboratory that will kill 3 or 4 years later to make sure you're silenced, so that she could be kept silent and isolated for a while. And within 4 years, less than 4 years, the anniversary of Watergate, Martha Mitchell was dead. I have a lot of feelings about Watergate in these last 4 years, and to summarize those events, I'll bring some of those up. It's hard to know where to start first. I suppose the article by Howard Hunt last week is an interesting one. In the newspaper, Friday, June the 4th, there was an article by his daughter, Lisa Tiffany Hunt Keel, K-Y-L-E, the daughter of Howard Hunt. And she claimed that her father has not been forgiven like Richard Nixon, that Richard Nixon was forgiven by America. And she asked, why not my father? Is he to be crucified for the rest of his life? The parole for Hunt is on January the 10th, 1977. He was sentenced to 2.5 to 8 years. He and G. Gordon Liddy are the only two Watergate men now serving in prison. Before imprisonment, she said, my father was a born fighter. He loved democracy. He loved justice. He was a man who loved his country so much that he followed orders for 20 years without any questions. Does that sound familiar? The Nuremberg trial, of course. She said that she has a child, going to have a child. She's pregnant. What am I going to tell my child about fairness and justice? She said, do we say that justice is a myth in America? Well, I suggest just off the cuff that she tell her child that the grandfather forged State Department papers to make John Kennedy, a deceased president, appear responsible for murdering another foreign leader, Mr. Diem, that he took the office in the White House, the Oval Office room, and a typewriter and razor blade and forged State Department papers. Tell her to look up the birth and death rate of Guatemala, the age the people die there, the kind of illnesses they die from, and the amount of money they earn each year, their life expectancy. And tell her how Guatemala was overthrown because this was one of the first cases that her father decided to test the muscles of the Central Intelligence Agency before they threw out Mr. Mossadegh in Iran and went on, or in which order, I don't remember. I think Iran was first. And then Guatemala, the grandchild might look up those figures of torture in Iran now, what's going on in the prisons, the actual physical torture, putting people between two screens or two iron mattresses and crushing them, and various instruments of torture and information coming out of Iran that the Shah of Iran is very adept at doing, and again go into the wages and the salaries and the life expectancy and what it's like for a student. And maybe the grandchild can look at Grandpa and say, did you have any part of the poverty and the torture in Iran or in Guatemala? She might inquire about the U-2 flight that was sabotaged and what role her child, or her, in this case her father, had in downing the U-2 flight, in working with the authorities and sabotaging a peace summit when the President of the United States looked forward to peace in the world, who had fought in a bitter war where 80 million people were killed. And she might want to inquire, do a little research into what happened when that peace conference was broken up and hope for peace shattered for many, many years. And even now we talk about the proliferation of atomic weapons. And she might ask herself what role her father had in that. She also might ask if the child's grandfather helped write the diary of Lee Harvey Oswald, or Arthur Bremer's diary, or Sirhan Sirhan's diary, because Howard Hunt was an author for Alan Dulles in those years, and those diaries were not authentic. They were not written by these people. And we don't know who wrote them, even though Hunt had approximately 40 books, and the writing style seems similar to these. And where was he November 22, 1963? And what was his role with the anti-Castro Cubans? Men that he worked with, like Mr. Barker, Frank Sturgis, who were giving interviews to the FBI. Frank Sturgis was under the name of Frank Fioriti when Kennedy was killed, from the Department of Misinformation, saying Oswald was a Marxist or Cuban sympathizer. Where was he? And was he named by persons in Europe as being part of a plan to kill de Gaulle in Paris? Was he on that team? And what about the deaths of Patrice Lumumba and Chamba and Che Guevara? What about those deaths and the executive action team? Was he used? Was he Howard Hunt used for these? What was his role at Chappaquiddick with Mr. DeMott? He was sent up there by the Hughes people, the Howard Hughes people, out of Robert Bennett's office, Mullen Associates. And what was he doing with a wig, trying to get Dita Baird to say that a memo that came off of her typewriter, in fact, it didn't come from that typewriter, to alter the course of the huge multinational conglomerate ITT. I think that when a AP story carries a sob situation, such as Lisa Kyle asking if there's justice in America, or is justice a myth, I have just as much reason to believe that justice hasn't even been served with Mr. Hunt. He was meeting with people like Donald Segretti, or handing money for the San Diego plan, and Arthur Godfrey, the FBI, or Godfrey have talked about the plans to kill Richard Nixon, to kill radicals, to make riots. And Hunt was out in Los Angeles with G. Gordon Liddy, part of Squad 19, the Los Angeles Police Department. And these people were funding money to the American Nazi Party and meeting at the Hilton Hotel and planning some good shootouts for the conventions that were then moved to Miami, where his co-workers that he hired, Mr. Frank Sturgis, got a church from the Internal Revenue. Just a few days before the Watergate arrest, Frank Sturgis was becoming a minister, tax-deductible church, and a church was used for a hideout, and Officer Tippett was killed in Dealey Plaza. These sad stories, as her father would be crucified for the rest of his life, make good copy, they make good reading, but they don't answer a lot of questions about Hunt, and he hasn't even begun to serve time for what could be real crimes, crimes of life, and these people should just shut up. She should really be glad that he's getting off as easy as he is, because January the 10th, 1977 rolls around, and he wasn't even charged for forgery when he was forging the State Department papers. Well, 4 years after Watergate, I see last week, June the 5th, 1976, a federal grand jury indicted a former Gulf Oil official for lying about how much corporate cash he smuggled in the country. Last week I was talking about the law enforcement protecting people who commit crimes. Our great hero, our folk hero, Judge John Sirica, gave immunity to Mr. William Viglia, V-I-G-L-I-A, from Gulf Oil. Why he gave him immunity, I don't know. None of these people were charged except for some meager fines for what they did. But he was given immunity on these charges of Gulf subsidiary in the Bahamas sending money. But this time he was indicted on a second time round, and there's been an indictment on this particular case. What was the crime of Gulf Oil with money in the Bahamas? Funds to distribute to more than 40 members of Congress. I spoke last week about our own congressman running for office here, Bert Talcott, or your congressman, wherever they are, and the necessity to look into dummy fronts or the possibility of dummy fronts who's giving money. Did money from the Bahamas go to Gulf Oil, to 40 members of Congress, and one of those 40, one of the most conservative that represents the oil interests, at election time or not election time or wherever voting goes, is our own representatives from this area? Gulf gave money to 40 members of Congress. We do not know who the 40 are or how their votes go, but you see, Judge Sirica had given this man immunity the first time around, but this time they caught him with an indictment. They caught him with an indictment because he was bringing in, according to the United Press International, $25,000 on nine different occasions, nine times 25,000, on nine different occasions in 1972 and 73, never declaring this excess. Now, that's a lot of money to bring in, and one of the people that was getting this money was Senator Hugh Scott, who wasn't punished for taking this money, this Watergate money. It's still going on. He isn't kicked out of the Senate. It's as big a disgrace as Representative Hayes cavorting around with his little chickadee. I think Senator Hugh Scott should be out for accepting Gulf money at all, illegal money, and they've acknowledged received $5,000 twice a year for the last 8 years. How does Senator Hugh Scott get punished for that? He gets put as a security on the Senate Intelligence Committee to screen illegal activities of the CIA. He was the biggest spokesman for Richard Nixon during the Watergate. He didn't get his ass kicked out of Congress like he should have. He wasn't put in jail like he should have been. He keeps his key committees. He still runs the show, and then he's put on the Intelligence Committee to boot after receiving $5,000 twice a year for 8 years from Gulf Oil. And this money is smuggled in from the Bahamas. And it continues to look as if Watergate, 4 years later, is not over by a long shot. It's not over because it's serious enough that these people get indictments dropped or even they're charged again. But one of the men who was a recipient of this money is still on the key Intelligence Committee, so we know Watergate isn't over. Martha Mitchell was kidnapped, injected. I wrote that in my Watergate story. Some of the things that I mentioned 3 weeks after the arrest was it was this kidnapping. I said that the Watergate affair would be too large for the Democratic Party to sue or to prosecute or investigate, and that turned out to be true. I wrote that it would take more than a hand-picked team to follow these clues left by the first arrest. It would take more than the Warren Commission selected, and it would take more than the hand-picked team. Senator Sam Ervin, it later turned out, was hand-picked. The CIA had control of him even before his investigation began. Leon Jaworski was hand-picked from the CIA Houston Anderson Foundation and never brought in. The worst crimes, the investigation of the murder of Mary Jo Kopechne, the Wallace shooting, the Dorothy Hunt plane crash, and they're still not investigating these things. I wrote earlier, 4 years ago, that all the five men arrested and the others left behind them would be connected with the CIA, and every single one of them, the five plus the other two, Hunt and Liddy, were. And I wrote that they were involved in the J. Edgar Hoover death and were brought up for demonstrations at his funeral. And then in the course of these last 4 years, it turned out that they were involved much more than that. And one of the Cubans even had an article in the Harvard Crimson saying that he was hired to put poison on the toothpaste of J. Edgar Hoover. I wrote about the money transactions and the money washings, that they would never be cleared up and that they would continuously be covered up, and that was true. And I also wrote that 1972 was the most important year in American history because this country was about to be overthrown. We had two countries, one visible and one invisible, two kinds of governments, and it would be now or never to find the truth. And I feel that because they haven't gone into that, we're still on the brink of a martial law plan that could happen any time. What I was referring to were actions that were taking place, such as the counterintelligence program, the COINTEL program, that broke up the anti-war movement, the United Farm Workers, the Panthers, the Socialist Party in America. Then there was the Charles Houston plan that was taking place, we learned out since I wrote that article in the course of the last years, within a year and a half after the article was published, and that was a combination of the FBI, the CIA, Navy intelligence, Army intelligence, all combined to open mail, to do burglaries, enter premises keys and go in, burglarize offices, follow people, keep data banks on people, against all our rights and privacies guaranteed by the Constitution. And then, of course, there was the famous enemy list, which had a group of people that were to be neutralized. And we learned since the Watergate arrests about the drug experimentations, the orders of the President of the United States to throw away drugs, and the facts of the drugs still do remain and are being used, and they didn't throw them away. And we've learned now about Operation Chaos. That's the same kind of a operation we used to overthrow countries, Operation Chaos in Greece and Brazil, and the 77 dictatorships I always refer to. It comes before the final takeover, and I just read this last week that the United States government is destroying their files on Operation Chaos so that you can't see how deep they go. In my Realist article, I said, this decisive year will determine if the secret power will be maintained by manipulating the candidates through assassinations or situations that would create martial law. They couldn't pull it that time because the money that would fund all this operation would be linked directly to the Watergate team, so we had a four-year rest on that. But the thrust of the article, based upon the allegations of Lewis Tackwood, were the plans to have the riots in Miami at election time, and then in the course of the Watergate investigations and after my article was written, we found out, as I say, that Frank Sturgis had this church front, that there was this San Diego plan, a plan that included killing Richard Nixon. There was Andrew Topping from New York who was hired and then arrested. He was supposed to get into the White House to kill Richard Nixon. And the evidence of the martial law, the troops being brought into Miami, the counterintelligence, was all there within months after I started my work. Of course, none of this was brought up in the final days. A lot of people ask me what I think of Woodward and Bernstein's book. I say it is to the investigation what pablum is to an adult person's diet. It's a washed-down story about two reporters who were fed enough information to get Richard Nixon out of office, and then we were blessed with Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan as the upcoming person behind Gerald Ford. Nothing was really accomplished, and it's a complete whitewash of the hard evidence of the weapons that were procured for Miami, the placement of the people in Miami that could cause the riots, the killing of Mary Jo Kopechne, as I say, and the Wallace shooting. All of that was covered up and not brought into effect, and that's what Watergate was about. You see, Richard Nixon said on his White House tapes that this thing goes back to the Bay of Pigs. It was the same team that worked with him in all these operations that had dated from the Bay of Pigs operation that he worked on. But the point was that they were frantic to destroy evidence, destroy tapes, shred papers, destroy the links that would link this team to specific murders or planned provocations. And they all chose to get arrested and get indicted on cover-up. In the 4 years that are over, John Mitchell and John Ehrlichman and Robert Haldeman and the various people involved, Robert Mardian, were charged with cover-up or perjury. In other words, they told lies and they covered up. But they still haven't told what they were covering up. And that's what I wrote about 4 years ago, and it's what I talk about continuously. And it's what Senator Howard Baker referred to as the underside of the iceberg. We've seen the tip. He closed shop, his investigating committee. And the same Senator Inouye, who did a half-assed job on the Senate Select Committee investigating the Watergate, has been promoted to the new Senate Committee on Intelligence because he showed that you can investigate something without getting any facts identical to the way the Warren Commission worked. Gerald Ford got his promotion and became president of the United States, and Senator Inouye is now on an investigating committee after covering up the Watergate story, really digging it under and hoping it would stay, and that's his reward. He will head that committee. And it will be compromised like all the other committees because they don't use the proper techniques to get to the heart of the matter, even though the evidence exists. The Watergate story is very much with us because continuously people are going to die that were connected to the Watergate, just like people are always dying that were connected to the John Kennedy assassination. Parade Magazine had an interview recently at the end of May about the difference between Clarence Kelly and J. Edgar Hoover. Somebody said, how does Clarence Kelly, current head of the FBI, compare to J. Edgar Hoover? And the answer was that Mr. Kelly is very open, that Hoover would never have a black agent or a woman, and he conspired to break-ins and burglaries and mail openings. And Clarence Kelly is a different breed. This is what we're told. This is the Public Relations Office of the Federal Bureau of Investigations. They say Kelly is more honest, he's open, he's tolerant, he's understanding, and he's democratic. To him has fallen the Herculean job of restructuring the morale and image and organization of the FBI. Well, he is honest to a point. He's tolerant of cover-ups. He's understanding, I guess, of the motives that go behind these things, and he's democratic because even members of their own team are being killed. But I do want to give you a list of some of the material witnesses that I've shared with you before about Watergate and show you how important it is that Watergate be opened up, and it hasn't even begun to be opened up any more than the Kennedy assassination was properly opened up by the federal agencies. The private investigators have done a good job, but the Watergate has not been investigated. A while back, there was an actuary on the death of 18 material witnesses. You might remember at the time of the John Kennedy assassination, and it said the odds against 15 material witnesses being dead in February 67, just 4 years after John Kennedy was killed, is 100 trillion? I don't even know the numbers. There's so many zeros. I guess it's 100 trillion to one that 15 material witnesses could be killed in this amount of time. I think there's more than trillion. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 18 zeros and a one in front. I don't know my math that well. All I know is that the actuary, the life expectancy, and the actuary done by the London Sunday Times showed that was a minimum of 1 trillion to 1 chances of being killed of 15 witnesses in 4 year period. So what do we have with Watergate in a 4 year period since Watergate took place? I have a list of 33 material witnesses, not counting the plane crash that Dorothy Hunt was on that took 45 other persons on the plane with her, but 33 material witnesses that have been murdered. The first and most obvious one is the secretary for Stephen Bull. That was the agent in charge of the White House taping system. What was important at that point was not getting Richard Nixon out, but what was on those tapes. And the secretary at that particular time was Beverly Kay. She worked for Mr. Bull until December 73. She reported to various friends that she knew too much. She was in charge of safekeeping the tape recordings of Richard Nixon's office. She stored and preserved the tapes in her desk. She died in the White House. She was taken downstairs with a massive stroke. A very young woman, she was taken downstairs with a stroke. Her funeral was paid for by the White House. The diagnosis or the autopsy was that it could have been caused by an injection or an air bubble. That's all that was in the news, that it could have been caused. She had written letters to her family about how depressed she was with the work she was doing. Stephen Bull, Secret Service agent, responsible over Beverly Kay, who had the missing 18 minutes on the tape, refused to allow her casket to be opened at the time of the funeral, even though she should have been in perfect condition. And absolutely perfect condition, funeral paid for by the White House, died at her desk in the White House, autopsy murky. She had letters indicating that she was afraid or knew too much, and that is one of the 33. The next person I have on the list is George Beall. At the time of the Senate select hearings, it came out that there was an enemy list. Now, an enemy list could be people that you don't have for dinner, or it could be people that were neutralized, like heads of states, because the CIA has and had an executive action committee for killing people, and domestically, we know how many are killed. When the name came up at the time of these hearings, Charles Colson was testifying. He was denied any involvement in the enemy list. But what he told the press was that the late George Beall kept the secret list. Now, George Beall died, like Beverly Kay, responsible for the enemy list. Now that he was dead, he could take the flak, but we don't know what he died from. Another interesting name of the 33 is Lew Russell, because a lot of people who do research have been suspicious of Bernard Fensterwald, who heads the committee to investigate assassinations, and they believe that he's linked to the Central Intelligence Agency. Lew Russell was giving money to James McCord. He worked for Richard Nixon, incidentally, in the House Un-American Activity, and his name comes in the hearings when Rosemary Wood is testifying. She didn't testify on national television, but afterwards she testified before the committee, and I have the bound volumes. And he came to the White House looking for a job. He worked for Nixon, early friend of Richard Nixon's, knew Rosemary Wood, went to the White House for a job, and went to work for McCord Associates, which was a dummy front that still belonged to the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, Russell was one of the links that took money to Bernard Fensterwald for his committee to investigate assassinations via Robert Mayhew from the Youth Organization. He took a dozen checks. So McCord and Fensterwald, according to the information at the Watergate hearings, were not supposed to have known each other, but then it turned out that Lew Russell, a connecting link, it was alleged that Lew Russell brought money from the Youth Organization, knew Rosemary Wood enough to go to the White House for a job, ended up with James McCord, and at the time of the Senate select hearings, Bernard Fensterwald from the Central Intelligence Agency was representing James McCord from the Central Intelligence Agency, a gentleman who's worked in Los Angeles for 21 years, who just came out with a book on the Kennedy assassination, claims that he worked with Fensterwald in the CIA. And you have this Lew Russell. Well, what happened after this information, this link came of Rosemary Woods, McCord Associates, the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, Robert Mayhew? Lew Russell was dead. Not much obituary, not much notice. He was the third of these Watergate parties. I'm not putting them in chronological order, but the ones that are interesting to me, I have them in a certain order here. Another is Ralph Blodgett, December the 8th, 1972. He took that fatal United Airlines with Dorothy Hunt. He was working in the legal department of Northern Natural Gas, Omaha, and he had documents with him that showed that the ownership of John Mitchell, of the gas company, John Mitchell, while Attorney General, owned stock in El Paso Natural Gas. I don't know if this is true or not, but Sherman Skolnick in Chicago has all that information. I have his name on a bibliography if you want to write to him about it. He claimed that a gas company was under antitrust investigation of the Justice Department, and Ralph Blodgett was afraid in Washington, D.C. He left Washington, and he told people there that he was afraid he would never live to get to Chicago. He was on the same plane as Dorothy Hunt, and he didn't live. Another important witness in the Watergate story is Murray Chotiner. He died January the 30th, 1974. Murray Chotiner is a long friend of Richard Nixon's, one of the original persons who called Richard Nixon when he was going to run for Congress from California, representing the Committee of 100. Chotiner was not called before the Watergate grand jury. He should have been called regarding the trial of James McCord, Hunt, the Cubans, and Liddy. His name comes up many times. It suggested that he received tapes from Alfred Baldwin from the Democratic headquarters. Baldwin was the agent over at the Holiday Inn or the Howard Johnson across the street, and the tapes went directly from the Democratic headquarters to Alfred Baldwin, and Chotiner's name is mentioned several times as possibly being one of those who received the tapes. Chotiner was a decisive witness in the case in New York City of Maurice Stans and John Mitchell on the allegations that Robert Vesco had given $200,000 to them and at the time of elections, illegal money. And at the time of the trial, Robert Vesco said, he's living in Costa Rica, he gave an interview, he said, if Murray Chotiner were alive, it would have changed the course of the trial for John Mitchell and Maurice Stans because they would have been convicted. So the one thing that kept the former Secretary of Commerce and the Attorney General out of prison or conviction was the death of an important witness, one of their team members, and that was Murray Chotiner. He was accused in his lifetime of almost every type of political chicanery. He admitted giving payments to Seymour Frieden, that was another journalist, to spy on the Democratic candidate, and gave him $1,000 weekly. Chotiner was involved in the White House milk orders. Later, we see John Conley getting off of a case down in Texas on milk funds. He's now being spoken of as a possible candidate or selection as the Vice President of the United States, and I don't know what would have happened to the milk fund scandal if Murray Chotiner had been alive and his name was linked to the milk orders and the $57,000 that Nixon received as a retainer from the largest dairy cooperatives. Murray Chotiner was there. He died of a car crash. A federal government truck ran into him. He died of complications. His wife placed a lawsuit against the federal government. It happened on a Sunday in front of the home of Ted Kennedy, who was playing tennis. And that was the end of Murray Chotiner. We have J. Edgar Hoover, I mentioned him before, who died May the 1st, 1972. Hoover's name comes up during the plans for the COINTEL program, the domestic counterintelligence operations, and the Tom Houston plans, because he disapproved of the combination of all the federal agencies doing these burglaries and wiretaps and mail openings. J. Edgar Hoover didn't go for that, and he could be erased. They hired somebody to head this organization, and J. Edgar Hoover declined. And according to Richard Nixon, the plan was shelved, but according to an attorney from Seattle, they still were going ahead with the plan. No autopsy was taken of J. Edgar Hoover, the excuse being he was an old man. I have a photograph of him in a hearse. It wasn't a hearse. It was a black car, like an old checkered cab. The body was taken away. It was printed in Orange County. When somebody saw that printed there and went to the newspaper for other copies, I understand all copies were destroyed. And it takes an expensive copier machine to duplicate these pictures, but I've seen them. The worst critics of J. Edgar Hoover were William Sullivan of Division 5 of the FBI, whose name comes out in unpublished documents and many other documents as being part of the team behind the John Kennedy assassination that should be investigated, his role from Division 5 of FBI. William Sullivan came out of Watergate. His name was prominent for stealing from the director of the Bureau, J. Edgar Hoover. Evidently, they weren't on such a friendly relationship that he couldn't get information from him and therefore was stealing it, and it ended up in the desk of John Ehrlichman. The Cubans were in town that weekend, the same Cubans hired by Hunt. They used aliases. They stayed at a hotel in Washington, D.C. It was Philippe de Diego, a Cuban exile, whose name also comes up at the Watergate Hotel and at the Dr. Lewis Fielding burglary, who was never charged with either of these. His name is silently vanished, and it may be because of any possible role he had in the J. Edgar Hoover murder that he was never charged, along with the other people, for entering Dr. Lewis Fielding's office or the Democratic headquarters, such as Gonzalez and Barker, Martinez, and Sturgis. Philippe de Diego was supposed to have been at the Watergate Hotel, registered there, and also out in California, but his name isn't linked to those. He claimed that Philippe de Diego claims that there was a break-in in J. Edgar Hoover's home, that they were ordered to do it. They were registered in Washington, D.C. at the Holiday Inn. 2 days before Hoover's death and used false names. At the funeral of J. Edgar Hoover, Diego and 10 of his Cuban friends were brought up by E. Howard Hunt to demonstrate, and they were supposed to make it look as if the anti-war people or the Ellsberg team were not religious or patriotic, and they had altercations on the step, provocateur type of thing, to make it look like some people didn't respect the late J. Edgar Hoover. The poison that he said they were supposed to use, I can't pronounce it too well, fine on thionphosphate, thiosphate, it was to be put on toilet articles. According to him, it can induce heart seizures undetectable unless there's immediate autopsy, and the autopsy is performed. So the question is, who ordered J. Edgar Hoover's body to be taken away, and why was there no autopsy, and was it just kept long enough to make sure that this drug was not detectable in the event there was an autopsy? Now, there was Dorothy Hunt's plane crash, of course, an outrageous, obvious to a lot of people and not obvious to Mr. Kelly, who took over the FBI when Patrick Gray went out. He's honest and open, and he'll hire blacks and women, but he will not go into the plane crash of Dorothy Hunt, even though the evidence exists of the altimeter and different parts of the plane being defective, and the FBI men were all over the field ready to receive the plane, and Mrs. Hunt was the most important bag woman for the CIA. She carried allegedly $1 million back. She was leaving Washington, D.C. She was carrying money for payoffs, as I said, the bag woman. And right after her plane crash, December the 8th, 1972, Mr. Egil Crow left the White House plumber operation and moved to become part of the Department of Transportation. 1 day later, Alex Butterfield, whose name you know, he was taping the president and caused the removal of the president of the United States, left the White House where he had this very important job of taping the president of the United States just a few months after Watergate, where they really needed him. He went to head the Federal Aviation Civil Aeronautics Division. And Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary to the president of the United States, was in Chicago, sent right out there to work for United Airlines. Mr. Crow was recently a disc jockey on KGO. He's worked for Swenson's Ice Cream, and now he's teaching at Golden Gate College this summer, and that's the way the beat goes on. And not one of them has been asked about this crime of Dorothy Hunt that not only took Dorothy Hunt, but took the other people, the pilots, the stewardesses, and 45 other people with her. Another interesting death was Lee Pennington. He died of a heart attack, October 1974. According to the report of William Colby to Senator Howard Baker, Lee Pennington was an intelligence agency for the Central Intelligence Agency. At the time of the Watergate arrest, the FBI wanted to inquire into Mr. Pennington, and the CIA purposely lied and withheld information and gave them, the FBI, the wrong name to confuse the investigation. But Mr. Pennington knew what he was doing, if the FBI didn't know, and he went immediately to James McCord's home to destroy any links of McCord to the CIA because they existed at the time of the Watergate. And he stood there, and Mrs. McCord was there. He burned files in the home 2 days after the break-in and maybe hours after, but certainly 2 days after he was there, destroying links of James McCord to the CIA. But Mr. Pennington didn't live long after that, and like Beverly Kay and other people who were instrumental in the manipulation of evidence, Lee Pennington died of a heart attack in 1974. J. Clifford Dietrich was another Secret Service agent who died off of a helicopter of Richard Nixon's of a mysterious accident while the helicopter was going to the Bahamas. This was in May 73. There was no radio call or warning of trouble. The other agents lived. There were seven agents aboard, but one fell over. He was 25 years old, and the circumstances of his death were mysterious. A Richard Lavoie of ITT, a guard for Dita Beard, died December 27, 1972, 6 months after the Watergate openings. He was chief of security for ITT. He had also another heart attack. His job in Denver was to see if Dita Beard was sick and that no harm fell to her, and that he knew all of her secrets. Her room was bugged, and he was responsible for her. The man who took his place, Mr. Lazzarini, was so shocked that after a very short period of time, he had a press interview and said he's quitting. He can't work with ITT. These are quotes. He says, they can do anything to you. They know everything before it happens. I've seen it. I've heard it. And I conclude that ITT can do anything it wants to do. It is a government all to itself. And he realized that the job of guarding Dita Baird in the Denver hospital and her children and informing on them was a dangerous one, and the man that preceded him was murdered. And so he quit his job. But Richard Lavoie died, the one that preceded him, and then one quit the job. There was Congressman William Mills, who died. I'm running out of time because we have 33 deaths here. Oh, Mike Nealon's here. Maybe he knows. This isn't 1 trillion. What's this figure here, Mike? I'm giving him that actuary to see how many that is, because it's greater, according to Lloyd's of London, 15 deaths in 4 years. 100 quadrillion. Mike is in the studio here. I knew it was more than 1 trillion. Okay, 100 quadrillion to one are the chances that 15 people would be dead within 4 years after the John Kennedy assassination. And we have at least 33. I have more at home since I made this list, but at least 33 that are dead since the Watergate arrest 4 years ago. And this is the anniversary of the Watergate. This is what we're talking about. As time will allow, I'll just go briefly through some of these names. I can't even go into the evidence. There's Congressman William Mills, found shot to death, like William Nolan in California, out by a river in the barn early in the morning, one day after it was reported that he failed to report $25,000 contribution that came to him illegally from the committee to reelect the president. Now, there was a lot of intrigue about this money, intrigue about Congressman Mills, and not only did he die, but his campaign managers both died. Second in command of his money, a James Webster and a James Glover. One was a retired military Air Force colonel, died in an automobile crash, and another one dispersed money to Mills' funds, allegedly, and this, remember, is Maryland, where George Wallace was shot during the 1972 elections, and the two men working on the campaign with him were both dead, James Webster and James Glover, of automobile accidents, and a 12-gauge shotgun suicide out by the barn is the way Congressman William Mills was supposed to have died. Another, James Morton, a missing link to Gerald Ford and his money washings when he came to Washington, died. There are allegations that Gerald Ford had laundered campaign funds, $11,000, in 1970 and turned them over to the GOP, that they were funneled from the Midwest. And Ford said he didn't know who the names of the donors were. But the committee treasurer, James Morton, responsible for secret funding of the now president of the United States, a political official for the chemical industry, was dead as soon as it turned out that he had links to the illegal money of Congressman Gerald Ford. And then, of course, Joseph Tomasi of the American Nazi Party was shot within a yard of the Nazi headquarters in California. He had been meeting with John Mitchell, Jeb Magruder, the committee to reelect the president, and Lynn Nofziger, who's now running the financial parts of Ronald Reagan's campaign. Joseph Tomasi was dead in his backyard, and those links of Lynn Nofziger to the American Nazi Party are concealed. Well, maybe next week on Dialogue Conspiracy, an anniversary of the Watergate death, I'll read you 20 more deaths, because time doesn't allow more. And I think maybe you can begin to think about what Watergate has done and what Mr. Kelly is doing back there to keep Watergate clean. One thing I have against Jimmy Carter, he gave a speech last week and said, now that Watergate is all clean and behind us and clear and beautiful, we can go forward. And I think we have to evaluate or maybe vote for the lesser of evils in an election. But that's a big boo-boo, and I think you might write to Jimmy Carter as candidate for president of the United States before he goes to the conventions and ask him what he means by saying Watergate is over, because the material witnesses are dying. As soon as evidence comes up that would affect a court case, such as the Melt case, the Vesco case, many cases, the presidency of the United States, Gerald Ford, the minute these scandals come out, the people are killed. There was an automobile accident of Mr. Stiles, the co-author of Gerald Ford's book about Lee Harvey Oswald recently. So we'll continue maybe on Dialogue Conspiracy next week on Watergate deaths, if it interests you. And I hope it does. And it's a bicentennial, so we'll give maybe 2 weeks to Watergate death so it can sink in to what's going on in Washington. Well, thank you very much. We'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. Keep cheerful, and until next week, that's it for now.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originated...